From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Colonel Kensel, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. We have a fun show for you today. We are taking a break from the news to get literary, or to put it another way,
we're playing librarian. And of course, by that, I mean sexy librarian.
In your case, Carl, that's redundant. We public radio people love books. For most of us here in public radio, that's because we appreciate the infinite stores of wisdom and information found in them, and also because we needed some way to pass the time when we were stuffed into our lockers.
Today, it's a Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me literary festival as we revisit some of our favorite interviews with authors.
Now, we'll start with this surprisingly adult story from Jack Gantos, who appeared in January 2012, right after he won the Newbery Medal, the highest award in children's literature.
He told us, along with panelists Brian Babylon, Roxanne Roberts, and Peter Gross, how he came to be the first felon to make it big in children's literature.
So, let's see. I was on my own in 12th grade. I lived in a welfare motel in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And then I was going to go to college to write books, but I drove up to University of Florida. It looked just like my high school, a giant football facility with a small academic institution like a tit that attached to the front. So I decided not to go and write novels in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. And I could work all day and drink all night, but I didn't feel fulfilled until I ran into these really nice British guys who had a boat with 2,000 pounds of hashish on it, and they said, "We're looking for a nice kid." I said, "I'm nice." They said, "We'll give you $10,000 to sail it to New York." That's 4 years of private school back then. I said, sure. I didn't know how to sail. I ran aground in the harbor. But
meaning the harbor leaving or the harbor arriving?
Both, actually. We got to New York. We docked it. And then we used to sell them. We would put big duffel bags full of hashish in stolen shopping carts and go through the streets of New York City and deliver them to apartments.
This sounds like the perfect crime, Jack. I can't imagine how you ever got caught.
Yeah, well, you should have seen the surveillance
photos. Wait a minute. You are pushing a stolen shopping cart down the streets of New York with a duffel bag filled with hashish. And I'm imagining you running across another young woman doing the same thing, and you're like, "Hello, who are you?" And she's like, "I'm Judy Blume. Who are you?" And I'm like, and you're like, "Maybe we'll meet again someday at the Newbery Awards." No, well, no, wait a minute.
Wait. Where did you get the shopping cart?
That's what you want to know? No, wait a minute. Hold on. Stop. Forget about the shopping carts. How did you get caught? What happened?
Well, the whole thing was rigged from the beginning because the British guys used American counterfeit money to buy the hashish in Morocco, and then the Secret Service got involved because there was all that bad money floating around. So they followed the boat, and then once I got on it, then they had aerial surveillance of the boat across the Atlantic Ocean, and so they had been watching it all along. All they were waiting to do was catch everybody. So then once we sold all the hashish, I moved into the Chelsea Hotel, a fine establishment for any writer.
Yeah.
And
no drugs there.
And then after that, I got paid. I got $10,000 in $10 bills. God, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
And then the FBI came in, the Secret Service came in, the customs officers came in, and I went out the back window of the Chelsea Hotel, but the guy who owned the boat went down to the lobby. He got popped, and I made it to the train station and took a train down to Florida.
Now, did they pay you in fake money?
You know, I never knew.
All right. So this is the most exciting interview we've ever had. So you're in the train.
I'm on the train.
Everybody's after you.
I dye my hair in one of those little train baths.
No, really? So you're down there. You're dyeing your hair. There's a soundtrack. Bum, 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 bum. And then what happens?
I got a rash. And then...
What's so amazing is I can so see the trajectory that leads from this to children's literature. But go on. So you're in the train, you're dyeing your hair, you have a rash now, you have blonde hair and a rash.
I go back to the welfare motel, which was run by Davy Crockett's great-great-granddaughter.
Where? This is in Florida?
In Florida.
In Florida, of course.
She had his wallet in her bra. And at any rate, it's another story. And,
yeah.
And, so at any rate, I called home. I thought, maybe I should call home. So I called my father. And he said, where the H are you? He said, I've got the FBI parked in the driveway. They're reading our mail and tapping our phones. And I said, I'm at a pizza parlor. And from there, I got an attorney. Now, don't do this. My attorney, honest to God, was Alfred E. Newman.
Wait a minute. I love that you've gotten this far in the story before telling us, now, don't do this, kids. You can smuggle the hashish. You can flee.
But if you hire a fictional character,
but here's
lawyer.
Where I don't want you to be like me.
And so, at any rate, so I go to court. I dress up. I look nice. And the judge, you know, asks me if I have anything to say for myself. I go, I'm guilty, Your Honor, but I'm a very nice boy. And he looks at me and he says, nice boys don't smuggle dope. And I was like, oh, you got me there.
I mean, how did you then become an award-winning children's author?
Well,
oh, I'm sorry, we're out of time. No, I kid. I'm genuinely curious how you go from prison to there.
Well, there is a little bit of work in between there,
yeah.
The transitional period. So at any rate, I always liked children's literature, and so I started writing picture books. And I wrote the Rotten Ralph books, and then I took them to the publisher when I was a sophomore in college, still on parole, and started placing picture books out there in the world. And then finally what happened is I started writing more novels, and I started winning some awards, National Book Award, you know, nominee, and a Newbery Honor for the Joy Pigza books, and I felt like I had a little bit of armor. So then I thought, well, this is the drug smuggling story. It's good. You know it's good. So I wrote that.
Now, we heard, I don't know if this is true, but we were looking into you, and there is a rumor that when you were running up and down the streets of New York in your shopping cart, that you buried about $5,000 worth of hashish in Central Park. Is that true?
That is.
It is true. Is it still there?
I wasn't going to tell you that.
Is it there? No.
Well, Jack Gantos, we've invited you here to play a game. We're calling,
oh, darling, take me in your arms.
You write very well for kids and young adults, but when people get older, their tastes change, and many then turn to romance novels. We're going to ask you three questions about those saucy novels, and if you get two right, you'll win a prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, on their voicemail.
Oh, boy.
Carl, who is Jack Gantos playing for?
Jack is playing for Eli Barnes of Madison, Wisconsin.
First question. Over the years, Harlequin Romance, the big imprint, has developed a number of specialty lines of romance novels for particular tastes, including which of these? A, Harlequin NASCAR. B, Harlequin Survivalist. Or C, Harlequin Democrat.
Wow. Okay, let's see. What's the most romantic there? Democrat? Nope. Survival? Or I go with NASCAR.
You're going to go with NASCAR. You're right. Next question. Romance novel author Susan Anderson had to apologize for a typo that changed the meaning of a line in one of her books. Was it A, that the hero was not, quote, desperately in need of a little late-night cookie? B, the couple did not, in fact, make sweat love? Or C, the line she had written as, quote, she felt his muscles loosen as he shifted on the ground, came out much differently. When the printer got a letter wrong.
You know, all three of them are pretty graphic.
It is true.
I have to go with the last one.
Yeah.
The
line that she wrote as she felt his muscles loosen as he shifted on the ground came out quite differently.
Yes.
That's right. That's what happened. You have the right answer. She had to post in her blog a rather exercised apology for that typo. All right, you're doing very well. Here's your last one. Romance novels cater to all tastes, which is why one bookseller is offering which of these sets of romance novels with a similar theme? A, the airport security bundle, including Love at First Flight and The Jet Set Seduction. B, the Hot Hot Kitchen collection, including The Long Order Cook and Turkey with Extra Stuffing. Or C, the Nerd Box, including Erotic Robotics and The Empire Strokes Back.
I got to tell you, because I already pulled it together for Eli here, so
yes,
now I don't have to even think. So I'm going for the Nerd Box.
You're going for the Nerd Box. I wish there was a Nerd Box of romance novels, but it was really the airport security bundle, of course. It's a strange theme. Carl, how did Jack do in our quiz?
Well, enough to win, Peter. He had two answers, so Jack, you win for Eli Barnes.
Well done. Congratulations. Jack Annos' book, Dead End in Norvell, just won the 2012 Newbery Medal. Jack Annos, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's a great time talking to you. Take care.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Colonel Castle, and here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you so much. This week we are putting the lie to the stereotype that authors are shy, retiring types with ink stains on their shabby cardigans.
Watch what you say about my cardigan, pal. Those are not buttons. Those are chick magnets.
When we went to Seattle in June of 2010, we wanted to talk to somebody who epitomized the Pacific Northwest flannel-clad hedonistic lifestyle.
Who better than Tom Robbins, whose novels inspired a generation and the message that sex can help you live forever.
You read his books, Carl?
I lived them, Peter. I am 210 years old.
I started by asking Tom Robbins when he started writing.
I've actually been writing since I was 5 years old.
Since you were five?
I have. There are stories still in existence that I wrote when I was five. However, I did not get published until I was seven.
Well, every writer does have to have his years of struggle.
I went to a large consolidated school in Appalachia. Grades 1 through 12 are all in the same three-story building. And I wrote the story when I was in the second grade, and I took it up to the third floor to the school newspaper office. It was written and edited by juniors and seniors.
Yeah.
And I slapped the story down on the desk, and I said, print this.
And did they?
And they did. And I thought, well, that was easy. Maybe I could do this for a living.
We have a question from one of our Twitterers. I sent this in to Twitter/WaitWait. Apparently, you have a love of mayonnaise?
Yeah, I eat so much mayonnaise, they were going to send me to the Mayo Clinic.
There are a lot of puns in your books, as a matter of fact. But is this true? Are you, in fact, a genuine mayo enthusiast, or are you putting us on?
No, I am indeed. I think it's the food of the gods. In fact, once, and this is a true story, having nothing else to mix the gin with, I put mayonnaise and gin in a blender and created a new drink that my friends and I called the gin greasy, I think.
The gin greasy.
Yeah. And it was we mixed it with, there were only two things in the refrigerator.
What were you drinking before you got to that idea?
In the refrigerator was blueberry pancake syrup and mayonnaise.
Lord.
So we didn't want to drink the gin straight.
Yeah.
And we tried it first with the blueberry pancake syrup, and it was awful.
Well,
then we mixed it with the mayonnaise, and it was actually pretty good.
Yes, on the heels of having it with blueberry syrup.
And ether.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about your latest book, B is for Beer. This is a children's book about beer.
True.
Why not? I'm all for this, but why did you think children needed a book about beer?
Well, children are exposed to beer all the time. Every time they watch any sporting event on TV, they sure. see beer commercials. But aside from that, and aside from beer's historical and philosophical background, don't you think that children really need to know why their daddy keeps a second refrigerator out in the garage? And why he's out there late on a school night with his shirt off listening to Aerosmith records.
Tom Robbins, we are delighted to have you with us, and we've asked you here today to play a game that this time we're calling
Unleash the Power Within.
I am sure this happens to you a lot. You're walking down the street and someone comes up to you and says, "Please, Mr. Robbins, help me find my greatest potential for success right now." And you say, "Oh, I'm sorry, that's Tony Robbins." Well, we are going to ask you about the other Mr. T. Robbins. Get two questions right, and you win a prize from one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is Tom Robbins playing for?
Peter, Tom is playing for Joshua Thompson from Cupertino, California.
All right. Here's your first question. Tony Robbins, as we know, is a big self-help mogul. He puts on seminars and shows. You can go to his private island in Fiji and learn from him. But for a handful of bigwigs, he does provide something unique for a fee of $1 million. Is it A, he'll give you his home phone number for a year, you can call him whenever you want, B, he'll appear in your family photos with you, or C, while motivating you, he will simultaneously get in touch with your rivals and enemies and demotivate them?
Well, considering the context, I'll say A.
You're going to say A, that he'll give you his home phone number. You can call him up whenever you want his help. Yeah. You're right. That's what $1 million per year gets you. Tony Robbins' home phone number.
Wow.
All right, second question. Tony Robbins has given advice to many world leaders, including Bill Clinton, and he claims which person who doesn't seem likely to need this motivational advice. Was it A, Mother Teresa? B, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il, or C, teen heartthrob Justin Bieber? One of these has consulted, according to Tony Robbins. Tony Robbins.
Well, Mother Teresa just sounds too good to be true. So I'll go with the Korean.
You're going to go with the Korean, that North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il, head of the Hermit Kingdom, has... I'd love it if that were true. That'd be great. But in fact, it was Mother Teresa. Tony Robbins says that he consulted with Mother Teresa, and Tony Robbins says, quote, "I asked Mother Teresa, tell me something, what really gives you ecstasy in life? And she said, what gives me ecstasy, Tony, is to see a person die with a smile on their face. And I thought, whoa, you know, not number one on my list," unquote. All right, this is the last question. Get this right, you win. As you may know, Tony Robbins not only teaches success, he exemplifies it. How did he describe his, quote, perfect day once to CNN? A, quote, "If I had a perfect day, I'd know there was nothing more I could do to improve myself, and thus I would ascend to heaven," unquote.
Boy.
B, quote, "A day in which some guy digging in a ditch in Bangalore says to himself, Tony Robbins believe I can do better than this." Or C, quote, "Make love to my lady, work out, have a great breakfast, and then, you know, go ride the Harley, go play polo, that type of thing," unquote. Which of these did he say was his perfect day?
Let's try C.
You're going to try C? Make love to my lady, work out, have a great breakfast, and then, you know, go ride the Harley, go play polo, that type of thing?
Sure.
Yes, that's what he said. Tony Robbins makes over $30 million a year making other people successful, and he likes to spend it on his expensive toys like helicopters and polo ponies. Carl, how did Tom Robbins do in our quiz?
Well, Tom came through at the end, Peter. He had two correct answers, and so he wins for Joshua Thompson.
Well done. Yeah.
Tom Robbins is the author of Still Life with Woodpeckers, Skinny Legs and All, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, and a whole bunch of other books you should just go read immediately. Tom Robbins, thank you so much for being with us. What a pleasure. Seattle's own Tom Robbins. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Author Susan Orlean has something in common with Margaret Thatcher, Julia Child, and that dingo ate my baby lady.
Meaning they've all been played by Meryl Streep. Susan got streeped in the movie adaptation based on a book she wrote called The Orchid Thief. We talked to Susan Orlean in December of 2011, just as her book about Rin Tin Tin hit the stores.
Our panelist, Mo Rocca, went right to her streepness.
I have a question. When Meryl Streep plays you in a movie, does she, like, come over to your house and follow you around the kitchen, like, to try to, like, act like you?
Well, this is terribly embarrassing, but I will tell you what happened. I was very excited when I heard that Meryl Streep was going to play me. So I would come into my office at The New Yorker, and I would just very casually say to my colleagues, oh, could you guys tidy up? I think Meryl Streep might be coming by today just to study me.
Yes.
You know, and then she wouldn't come by, and then another week would roll around, and I'd again say to people, you know, could you kind of clean up in here, guys? I mean, I think Meryl Streep's probably going to come and, you know, study me. Well, then at one point I said to the producer, so look, I mean, is Meryl Streep going to come? And they said, oh, we already shot her scenes. She really just wanted to create the character kind of on her own and didn't want to study you. And then, so I was eating a lot of humble pie at the office.
So let's talk about Rin Tin Tin a little. I want to say that I picked up your book with a sense of heavy obligation, in that I wanted to read the book because you were going to be our guest, but I am totally uninterested in dogs. I only had the vaguest idea who Rin Tin Tin was, and ended up just loving it. So, I mean, it's a book for everybody who thinks they hate dogs.
Right, that's right. It's actually a book for dog haters.
Dog haters, exactly. And there's so much in that book I did not know. For example, that Rin Tin Tin was not a character but a real dog.
And that is exactly what drew me into the story, because having grown up at the very tail end of Rin Tin Tin, having been a TV star, and knowing him just as a character in television, it completely astonished me to learn that he was a real dog born in 1918.
Right.
And a dog who had had a huge career and a sort of global acclaim in the 1920s.
To summarize very briefly, Rin Tin Tin was found on a battlefield in World War I by a soldier named Lee Duncan, who brought him home to America and got into the movies, and he became one of the biggest movie stars in the world.
In the 20s, when Rin Tin Tin was in a movie, he was the name above the title.
Jeez,
he was the big deal.
I love the fact that, as you write, that like the gossip magazines used to write about him like a movie star. Like they say he lived in a hotel suite with his wife, Nanette, right?
Right. Actually, my favorite report was where they presumably interviewed his wife, Nanette, who said she was putting aside her career for the time being, because of the demands of motherhood.
Was he fixed?
Definitely not.
Oh, okay, good. So he could enjoy his celebrity.
He really enjoyed his celebrity.
He could run for president now.
If you see one of the silent films, you will know quite immediately that he was not fixed.
Right.
And he had 44 puppies.
Wow.
For the newcomer to this, what are the essential differences between Rin Tin Tin and Lassie?
The essential difference, and it's a real difference, which is there's no story about Lassie. Lassie was a fictional character who became a television character. Rin Tin Tin was a real dog with this amazing life story of having been found on a battlefield, brought back to the U.S., became, through, you know, kind of luck and chance, an actor, a star, and then became a character. So his story was much more complicated.
Yeah. You're Timmy. You're in a well. Who do you call?
Yeah. Well, you know.
That's the question. Can I say, by the way, and I say this to you as someone who's written a book about a famous performing dog, that I did not get a dog until I was a freshman in high school, 14 years old, say. And by that time, I was so ruined by fictional dogs ranging from all the movie dogs to the TV dogs to Snoopy. And then you get a real, finally, after a lifetime, a kid's lifetime of wanting one, you get a dog. And it's just a dog. It doesn't talk to you. It doesn't, like, run errands for you, bring you your, doesn't even bring me my slippers. It just kind of panted and ran around and occasionally would poop outside. That was it.
Right.
But isn't that what marriage is like, too?
Where you poop outside?
Well, Susan Orlean, we have invited you here to play a game we're calling...
Rin Tin Tin is just the begin-gin-ginning.
Uh-oh.
So we were talking about Rin Tin Tin, and somebody said that sounds like the Tintin comics, and that sounded like Tauntauns from Star Wars, and we sort of got carried away. So we're going to ask you three questions based on three things that sound like the title of your book.
Oh, good. I'm probably guaranteed to flunk all of these.
That's the plan. But if you answer two out of these three questions correctly, you'll win a prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is author Susan Orlean playing for?
Susan is playing for David Gaze of Oak Park, Illinois.
Ready to play?
I am.
All right. Tintin is, of course, a famous Belgian comic book hero, and he's the basis for the new Steven Spielberg movie. His BFF, Captain Haddock, is known for his elaborate curses. Which of these is a genuine Captain Haddock expletive? A, blue, blistering, bell-bottom balderdash. B, filibustering, French-fried frankincense. Or C, hairy hedgehogs on a stick.
Whoa.
Yes.
I'll say number one.
Blue, blistering, bell-bottom balderdash?
Yeah.
You're right. The idea... Captain Haddock is a sailor, and the author Hergé wants him to swear like a sailor, but not actually swear. So that's good. So that was Tintin. Next up, Tauntauns. As all Star Wars fans know, they're the beasts on the ice planet Hoth, famous for that bit where Han Solo cuts one open to make a nice warm hot pocket for the injured Luke Skywalker. What is the latest Tauntaun-themed Star Wars merchandise? A, the Craftsman Star Wars Edition chainsaw, which is, quote, tough enough to open a Tauntaun. B, a sleeping bag that looks like a Tauntaun. You unzip and get to keep yourself warm by climbing in. Or C, a loaf shaped to look like a Tauntaun to be enjoyed on a Star Wars nerd holiday called Life Day.
Ooh, I'm going for B.
You're going for B, the sleeping bag?
Yeah.
You're right.
Oh, my God.
This is the Tauntaun sleeping bag.
I can't believe it.
Which is great is that this, the Tauntaun-shaped sleeping bag, which you could cut open and then crawl inside yourself, was actually an April Fool's joke on a website called ThinkGeek. But the response to it was so overwhelming that they just actually started manufacturing them. All right, we've had Tintin, Tauntaun. How about TomTom? The GPS system that uses celebrity voices to give directions. Which of these is a real celebrity instruction you can get on your TomTom GPS? Is it A, Snoop Dogg saying, Jeeza Frieza, put your keyza in the ignition? B, Kim Kardashian saying, if you turn left at the next light, I'll marry you. Or C, Cormac McCarthy saying, the road is long, hungry, cold, find food or die. Yes, that is the way of it.
Oh, my God. Well, I know which one I would buy, but my guess is that it's number one.
Snoop Dogg?
Yep.
You're right. Very good. Here is a sample of Snoop Dogg helping you find your way.
G's up, freeze up, put your keys up in the ignition and let's turn this thing on.
There you go. You're ready to go. Carl, how did Susan Orlean do in our quiz?
Susan, you had a great game. Three correct answers, so you win for David Gaze.
Well done.
God.
Bravo.
I am so proud.
You should be.
I really am. I'm really proud.
You know what, Susan? You get a bacon treat.
Yeah.
Wow.
Susan Orlean is the author of the new book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. It's out now. Susan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye, Susan.
Thank you.
He's Private Rin Tin Tin. They are the Army's pride.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Cancel, and here again is your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you so much. This week we're revisiting some of our interviews with authors, and the next one is one of my personal favorites. In her books, Science writer Mary Roach loves to write about the dirty, icky, and strange, from sex to what happens to our bodies after we are done with them.
Mary joined us in September of 2010 and explained what drove her unique set of interests.
I have the mind of a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell.
Mary, having read your books, I could take that to mean that you actually have one sitting on your shelf, because I know you can get around.
No, that's just the head, Peter. No,
sorry,
mind.
Excuse me. That was removed. But no, you and of course, in your latest book, I Should Not Neglect Packing for Mars, which is about humans in space, you spend an awful lot of time talking about, shall we say, the elimination function.
That's the 12-year-old boy angle. But it's a fascinating topic, is it not?
Oh, I can't get enough of it myself. So how do you pick your topics?
Well, it's got to have a little science, it's got to have a little history, a little humor, and something gross. So
right.
That pretty much leaves sex, dead bodies, and poop.
There you are.
So after this, my career is done.
Right. What was really interesting to me about this book is because it made me think about something that I had not thought about before, which was exactly how much planning and preparation has to go into sending people into space. And to me, among the most interesting parts of the book is the testing of the psychological experience of being in space.
Yeah, talking about 5-6 people in a little tiny room for weeks, months, years at a time, I mean, can you imagine anything worse?
Yeah. Well, one of the things you write about is sort of the space travel version of cabin fever, where people locked in the small space together for weeks at a time can get very, very hostile towards each other.
Yeah, they get very hostile, but here's the thing, they can't take it out on each other because they, you know, that makes the situation worse. They depend on each other for survival, so they turn it inward, and then they get sort of depressed. And I interviewed this cosmonaut, Alexander Levake, and I said, he was up on Mir for 6 months. I said, did you get really depressed? And he said, Mary, there were times when I wanted to hang myself, but of course, it's zero gravity. And you can't.
The other thing you write about at some length in your book is the extraordinary science and preparation and technology that goes into using the restroom in space, because it turns out that we, as you point out, are evolved to do that sort of thing here on Earth with gravity.
Yes, gravity is your friend, because gravity gives you good separation.
Between you and what you're trying to rid yourself of.
This is the holy grail of the NASA waste management team, good separation. Because without gravity, the contributions, the contribution to the toilet, it just kind of hovers. It doesn't fall. You don't have the plop. So you need to encourage the material to go down into the toilet some other way, so they use airflow. It's basically you are sitting on a shop vac.
That's terrifying.
But then they need to test the toilet, too. That's when it gets really scary.
They test the toilet?
Okay, they have to make sure it works in zero gravity. That means you have to haul the whole thing over to Ellington Field and load it onto one of those zero gravity planes that goes up and down. And you have 22 seconds of zero gravity to test it.
No way.
I talked to a guy who was on that flight, and he says that there was a curtain between him and the toilet. He said, when we go over the top, you'd see the toilet rise up off the bottom of the plane, and you'd hear these guys going, go, 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 go!
That sounds like the best fraternity hazing of all time.
Mary Roach, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
It's-a-me, Mario.
As I'm sure you've noticed by the national celebrations, parades, and solemn ceremonies, this week was the 25th anniversary of the release of Super Mario Brothers, the greatest and most long-lasting video game franchise of all time. So, Mary, answer two questions correctly about Mario and his friends. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on your home answering machine. Carl, who is author Mary Roach playing for?
It's a Phil Esterda of a Poughkeepsie, New York.
Do I need to reset you, Carl? Are you ready to play, Mary?
I think so.
All right. Here's your first question. Mario was known in Japan as Jumpman, but he became Mario first in the United States and then the rest of the world because, well, why? A, the discussion about what to name him was interrupted by the landlord looking for the rent. The landlord named Mario. B, one of the designers based the character on his favorite nun back in parochial school, Sister Maria. Or C, one of the designers had an uncle named Mario he hated, so he wanted to drop barrels on him.
I'm going with barrels.
You're going with barrels. He just hated his Uncle Mario so much he wanted to drop little pixelated barrels on him. No, I'm afraid it was actually A, it was the landlord. This happened in Seattle. The Nintendo USA, the designers were trying to come up with a name for the American version, and the landlord, Mario Segale, comes in and says, "Where's my rent?" And they said, "Aha, Mario." There you go. All right, two more chances. Mario faces a lot of enemies in his various games, including the Boo enemies that first appeared in Super Mario 64. These are quiet little ghosts that will suddenly attack you when you get close. They were inspired by what? A, the game designer's dog, B, the game designer's wife, or C, the game designer's own legendary temper?
I'm going to go with the... the wife.
Yes, the wife. Very good. We quote from an account of the invention of the game. His wife is very quiet normally, but one day she exploded, maddened by all the time he spent at work. In the game, there is now a character who shrinks when Mario looks at it, but when Mario turns away, it will grow large and menacing. All right, this is great, Mary. You have one more chance to get it right. Here we go and win the game. Believe it or not, but back in 1993, there was a live-action movie made of the Super Mario Brothers game. It was called Super Mario Brothers. In his autobiography, star John Leguizamo says that he and co-star Bob Hoskins made it through the difficult and demanding production by doing what? A, constantly playing the game on set. B, making up elaborate backstories to explain how Mario and Luigi became plumbers. Or C, drinking heavily.
I'm going to go with the backstories.
That's your choice, huh?
Yeah.
All right. No, it was drinking heavily.
Oh, no.
Have you ever seen this movie? You practically need to get slammed just to finish watching it, let alone acting in it. No, the movie, it was in fact the first major motion picture to be made from a video game, and it was an absolute disaster for everyone involved. Carl, how did Mary Roach do in our quiz?
Mary needed at least two correct answers to win for Phil Sturt, but she had just one correct
answer. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. It's all...
Woo, 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 woo.
Mary Roach is the author of a bunch of great, fascinating, and funny books, including Bonk and Stiff, her latest is a great book called Packing for Mars. Go get it now. Mary Roach, thank you so much for being with us. Great to have you on the show.
If you're a novelist, you have to spend a lot of time trying to think up characters and plots so odd, so extraordinary, that they can captivate an audience that's seen it all.
Or you can just live in South Florida and write down what happens outside your window. Carl Hyacin has written several best-selling novels about extreme behavior in Florida, and he says all he's done is change the names.
We knew he was the man to talk to when we went to Miami in February of 2011 and invited him to join us with panelists Roxanne Roberts, Mo Rocca, and Alonzo Bowden.
Roxanne asked him to get specific about what made South Florida so special.
Before you go further, can you give us a one sentence on the nature of the weirdness? Because everyone knows of the weirdness, but not the why of the weirdness.
Well, I think it's sort of an amiable depravity, I would describe it as. You know, we're all in this together. This is really, Florida has always been a magnet for outlaws and scoundrels and sort of a predatory element. We have, for many years, we were flooded with retirees from up north.
Yes.
And the people moved with that herd down here to prey upon them.
Right.
And,
So, and I mean, that's almost like a Mutual of Omaha kind of scenario.
Is, yeah.
And here come the herds of buffalo.
It's no which
trailing way. Them the vultures.
It's the wildebeest on the Serengeti.
Yeah.
Only here.
Right.
And the rest of
the
us.
The wildebeest are all driving Cadillacs very slowly.
That's right.
Ha 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 ha. So let's talk about the last couple of years since last we spoke. To me, one of the more interesting things that you've done is elect your new governor, Mr. Rick Scott. Which is... Now, Rick Scott, who we haven't mentioned on the show before because we were afraid no one would believe it, this is his first elected office.
Right.
And his prior experience was running a healthcare company which defrauded the federal government out of about $1 billion.
Yes, it was the biggest Medicare fraud in the history of Medicare. Mm.
Right. And so explain to me, as a native Floridian, the mindset that says, this is just the man to handle all of our affairs.
Well, it's sort of the same reason that I've always advocated that felons should be allowed to vote. Because who better qualified to judge the politicians
exactly.
in our state?
Right, right.
But getting back to Scott, he ran a very, very successful campaign. He spent, I don't know, $78, $80 million of his own money, which yes. used to be our money.
Our money, yeah.
But he had one of the greatest campaign slogans ever, which was, hey, they never indicted me. And, you know, no Floridian could resist that.
That's true. Your last book, the book before that was actually a memoir about playing golf.
Oh,
picking
God.
Up golf again?
Yes, it was terrible. I'd given up golf for about 36 years, and I was persuaded to go back. It's probably the most... disturbing book I've ever written, and it's nonfiction.
Why disturbing?
Because of the things that happened to me, and because some of the language was... I couldn't show that book to my mother, ever.
You're one of those people who swear a lot on the golf course?
Yeah. Well, if you saw what happened, it's carnage. It's a terrible, dreadful sport. And so I just... I started it up again, and a friend of mine, Mike Lupica, the sports writer, said... And I would call him up, and he's a good golfer, and I would tell him what had happened to me. One day I sunk a golf cart, and I thought...
Wait a minute.
You know...
Stop.
I sunk the golf cart, and I thought, well, this must...
In what?
In a lake.
All right.
Yeah, in a lake. And I thought, this must happen all the time, because there's hills on golf courses.
And lakes.
And lakes, and if you don't set the brake, by golly, that's what happens. And I'm, to this day, insisting there was a brake problem. But anyway, so I call up Lupik. I would tell him these stories. There were snake incidents. There were a few other things that happened that weren't very pleasant. And he would just say, you've got to start keeping a diary, because this doesn't happen to anybody else. And I said, you've never sunk a golf cart? He said, I've been playing golf since I was 6 years old. I don't even know anybody who sunk a golf cart. So that was why I wrote this book. It was called The Downhill Lie, and it was just about everything bad that it happened to me. There was an incident involving live rats and a 7-iron, which...
Were they live at the end of the story?
No, ma'am, they were not.
Well, Carl Hiaasen, we are really glad you're here. We've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Where we are from, frozen water falls from the sky.
You've lived your whole life in Florida, so what the hell do you know about winter? The only way that you can tell the seasons are passing is the waxing and waning of snowbirds on the beach.
No, you know what? How you can tell?
How can you tell?
The color of the license tags change.
Really?
Yes. Am I right? That's how you know.
So, we are going to ask you about what we people from the northern climes do to enjoy ourselves in the winter. Get two of these questions right. You'll be a prize for one of our listeners. Carl, who is Carl Hiaasen playing for?
Carl is playing for Karen Eckstein of Orlando, Florida.
All right. Here's the first question. You ready?
Yep.
All right. One sport, a winter sport, was invented, according to legend, by bored ski lift operators in the 1970s. Is it A, bong jumping, B, shovel racing, C, injury predicting?
I'm going to go with bong jumping.
You're going to go with bong jumping?
Yeah, because that sounds okay.
It sounds like fun. No, it was shovel racing. See, the ski lift operators all have shovels to remove the snow.
Yeah, right.
One day they were bored, gotten a shovel. Yeah, there you go.
That's okay.
Fine.
Yeah, fine.
Sorry.
Shovel racing.
There are other countries, next question, there are other countries that have winter besides ours. One of these is a winter recreation somewhere else in the world. Is it A, shark ice fishing in Greenland?
B, full contact figure skating in Siberia.
Oh, that's
or
great.
C, nude snowshoe racing in Norway.
Ooh. Oh, God. That sounds too happy, right?
It does sound
Norway.
Happy, but you know what? I'm going to go with that.
You're going to go with what? What are you going to go with?
The nude, was it snowshoe?
It was nude, I think, yeah. Nobody's looking at the snowshoes, though. It was nude snowshoe racing in Norway. Now, do you think that's true, or do you wish that were true?
You're probably right. What was
the other two were shark ice fishing in Greenland.
No, I'm going to go with the shark ice fishing.
You're right. It's shark ice fishing. You've yourself been known to wet a line, as I say. You like to fish.
Yes, I like
right.
To
so
fish,
you probably will understand the appeal then of walking out in a frozen bay in Greenland in the middle of winter, digging
one.
A very large hole and trying to catch a Greenland shark, which go up to about 21 feet.
Yeah, I mean that's one thing we miss here in Florida. With
ice fishing.
Yeah, it just kills us to
to know that you're missing out on that experience. Yeah. All right, you've got 1 for 2. Get this one right, and you'll win. In 1918. The New York Times and other papers heralded a new hybrid winter sport that they thought was sure to catch on around the country. It was which of these? A, ice tennis, all the balls of tennis, none of the traction needed to get to them. B, ski jump wrestling, in which the guy on top, when they get to the end of the ramp, wins. Or C, ice brick dodgeball, the sport that nobody played more than once.
Well, I'm sorry, the first one again?
Ice tennis.
Wait, which publication? Did you say New York Times?
New York Times actually
York
mentioned
Times
this, yes.
I think it's got to be tennis if the New York
ice
Times.
Ice tennis?
Yeah, because I don't think the New York
they're
Times.
They're a bunch of snobs. That's the sort of
they're
spot
they're not going to go for naked guys wrestling.
I didn't say anything about them being naked.
No. Oh. Sorry.
I was right there with you.
All right. But your choice, hold on. For whatever sick reason, your choice was ice tennis.
I think it has to be.
And you're right. It is ice tennis. Well done. One Illinois paper said of ice tennis, quote, it is expected that the idea will be imitated by many clubs throughout the country. That expectation was not met. Carl, how did Carl Hyacin do in our quiz?
Well, he had 2 correct answers, so Carl wins for Karen Eckstein. Congratulations.
All right. Good.
Well done. Carl Hyacin is an award-winning author and columnist. His latest book is Star Island. You must read it. Carl Hyacin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For joining
me.
Thank you. Carl Hyacin, ladies and gentlemen, well done. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. Esurance, an Allstate company, offering tools to help guide customers through the car insurance process, from quote to claim. Learn more at esurance.com. And to the National Association of Realtors, an advocate for homeownership, more at houselogic.com/homeownership. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions, Doug Berman, Sexy Librarian. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Emily Ecton and Eva Walchover. Our technical directors are Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. Ian Chillog is our senior producer. The executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle, all of our panelists you heard, all of our great guests, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal, and we will see you next week. This is NPR.